Here we are, KXLU 88.9 FM in LA, KXLU.com all around the world. Mystic Pete here with a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. We're getting into the darker hours of the 7 o'clock time. Now it's almost feeling like wintertime, right, Dark
it
Bob?
It certainly is feeling that way. It's cold, dark early. I can't stand it.
I mean, it was like brutal today. It was like a 70. I had my shorts on and I was almost a little chilly. It was that bad.
I get you. That's what's happening to me these days. Yeah. I'm wearing your shorts and I'm like not getting it.
It's a little too. We have Dark Bob in studio today, a very special guest. He was here 2-3 months ago and we had such a good time. And I thought, oh, that's a guy I want to do more radio with.
I like it. I'm glad.
And we have Ryan Zinn in studio too. Say hi, Ryan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me, Mystic Pete. Oh, it's an honor to be here on the show. And it has been cold today. I found myself, I was wearing shorts too, but with long underwear. It's very strange.
Oh, that was you running down the beach.
That was me running down the beach
with the police chasing
you. Loyola campus everywhere.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm doing like burlesque on the beach, but it's kind of reversed because people are like throwing money at me to put my clothes back on. So, you know, it's just what it is. But this leads to kind of a theme of tonight. Now, Bob here was a half of Bob and Bob.
That's right.
You were the Dark Bob.
Yes.
And a seminal force in the performance art community in Los Angeles.
That's what they say.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say. So let's start there.
Okay.
Ryan's got a whole things I can't even pronounce. But let's start with Dark Bob. Bob and Bob. Take us from the beginning.
Well, let's. Bob and Bob was a conceptual art team that I was half of. You could say I was one of the founders. We popped up in the world somewhere in the mid 70s in the art world, doing performance art, video, little films. And this was a time when people were saying that painting was dead. So L.A. was looking for new ways to express themselves artistically, and all these alternative methods were coming up, like performance art and video art and so on. And so we were a conceptual art team that also painted and did drawings and so on. The West Coast still was a very small art world. Most of the attention was still being focused on New York. So I think because of that, because not a lot of people were looking at L.A., there was a lot more courageous explorations going on out here because nobody cared and nobody was paying attention. So artists were taking chances here that they weren't taking in other places. And that created an art world that was pretty exciting. And we weren't alone. There were many others exploring different methodologies. Chris Burden, Paul McCarthy, Barbara Smith. These are all big names in the performance art world.
And we're going to talk about them a little bit
later.
We
might.
Okay.
Sure.
We're going to reminisce. at some point, a little later.
I like that. Of course, I can't remember anything, but we'll try.
You know, part of being a performance artist.
And just to wrap up the Bob and Bob thing, we're working together currently for an exhibition we're having early next year, a drawing retrospective. And we're both happy to be together and working together again, and it's kind of fun. And I'll keep you posted as things evolve.
Well, I love it. So let's go back a step, and let's do some defining for the public. Performance art and conceptual art, like people think of, if I just nail a banana to the wall and charge $1 million, put a frame around it, you know, that's art. So explain to us
what you just said. It was a recent reality.
Yes.
Someone taped a banana on the wall and sold it for $6 million.
Maybe one million. I bid a million.
No, that's why you don't have it and someone else does. We actually did that in the mid 70s.
Did it first?
We did. I'll tell you, we did a performance called School of Painting. And what it was there was a bowl of fruit in front of us, and we were supposed to be painting this bowl of fruit in a classroom situation. So there would be a professor in there. And when the professor stepped out to have a cigarette, we just took the fruit and taped it on the canvas. And when the professor came back in, he was like, oh my God, it's beautiful. It looks like it's coming right off the canvas. It's so realistic. So we did that. But it did not sell for $1 million.
It was ahead of your time. A visionary. That's the problem with visionaries.
That's right. Yeah. Visionaries never get paid.
But can you define a little what is happening here so it gives people entry so they understand it and not just mock it? They can mock it.
Yes, performance art is something late night comedians use or pundits on the news use to define something that they think is crazy or inexplicable. It's like, oh, well, that's performance art.
It's mocked generally.
But what's
the art of it?
I have a little higher regard for it. I do think it was because of the way it came about back there in the 70s. I think the world was still recovering from the 60s in a way, where just about every corner of expression had been tested to its limit. In popular music, in pop art, in Timothy Leary, the Beatles, all that stuff. So in the 70s, the world was in pieces from the 60s, and artists in the 70s were just trying to put it all back together. And performance art was a way of assimilating various tools of expression that might incorporate sound, lighting, physical actions. So it wasn't exactly theater. It wasn't comedy. It wasn't rock and roll. It was something else. Now that I think about it, it was awful. There was some great art.
I would like to make a comment,
yes,
though, and then you'll keep going. But performance art, if it's really good, mm-hmm, it's good, but it's easy to be bad.
Very easy, yes,
yeah,
that's right.
Okay. If you're brilliant, you can change consciousness.
Right.
Okay.
Now, there are some artists who are regarded as brilliant that maybe the mainstream culture would not agree. And, was it brilliant when Chris Burden had himself shot and called it art? Or when he took off his clothes and crawled through broken glass? I think it was, because I see what he did sort of part and parcel to the burgeoning culture of punk, what we know in music, punk music. But no one was more of a punk than Chris Burden. He didn't make music, but he took off his clothes and crawled through glass.
I said, God, now that just helped everybody and me. It's like a punk analog. It's art.
Yeah.
The punk. It's kind of like...
F-U to the system. And
that woman in New York who took off all her clothes and invited people to do whatever they wanted to her
body. That was my sister.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. No, you're thinking maybe of Barbara Smith.
No, another one. I'll figure it out.
There are others. But okay. Here in L.A., Barbara Smith did a very famous piece called Feed Me. And Barbara's one of the seminal performance artists that is now, you know, having museum shows around the world and regarded as a pioneer feminist important artist. In fact, maybe we'll play one. I wrote a song for Barbara.
So we're winding our way to hearing some of your album, which is a tribute album to a lot of these people. We'll get there in a minute.
Right.
But let's finish with the definitions.
All right. Well, so Barbara did a piece called Feed Me. And she was in a hotel room. It was promoted that she'd be in this hotel room all through the night. And she was in this room, and anyone was invited to go in there and do whatever they wanted. She was nude. She had wine and pot sitting around and music playing, candles lit. And there was a lot of myth that people just went in there and everyone had sex with Barbara. That wasn't really what happened, although her boyfriend did visit. And yeah, they did, I guess. But the piece has taken on quite a mythology. And, you know, in many ways for a woman to do that, to just say, feed me and open herself up to random possibilities, was a very brave thing to do. And maybe part and parcel to what was coming up as the feminist movement, where women were, you know, finding their power in performance art, especially, the feminist movement really flourished and produced a lot of great, brave work. And I also wrote a song for the feminists of that era, an anthem.
This album.
Yes, it is.
It's
a great song.
Mike Mollette and S.A. Griffin were here. They had the Mud People.
He loved them.
So this is a powerful, like, a lot of people will not understand. They'll be confused. But there's something happening, and if you're holding consciousness, presence,
yes,
some kind of artistic expression,
yes,
powerfully enough,
then
it's, oh, yes, this is art. This is not just like some weird thing. This is a powerful expression of creativity.
And Michael Mollette in particular, and those Mud People, that was an area of performance art that was shamanistic. And dealt with more of a spiritual need of people to connect with a higher consciousness of some sort. So there was, it looked very primitive, but it was what he did with the Mud People. It's very beautiful. You know, they'd take off their clothes and cover themselves in mud and slowly move around. But it was also spiritually moving on some level.
Something like Buteau.
Yes.
And so these, like, even Buteau people don't understand what that is, but this is kind of a performance art. Ryan, you wanted to say?
Yeah, if I may offer a point of view on performance art, kind of as an outsider, but one I've gained from doing some interviews with performance artists and also growing up steeped in the kind of mythos of it. I think the overarching like ethos of performance art is very much that the medium is experience rather than the actual like physical work. And I think that kind of tackles the talking point that a lot of people raise of maybe like the physical art of it actually maybe not being good or not up to the standards that they want to judge it on. It's really the goal of, I would say, a good performance piece is to create a powerful experience among the viewer, whether it's, you know, being viewed through ephemera or through a video or an actual live experience. But it's about creating a powerful experience rather than just like the ephemera that's taken away from. And I think that's where a lot of people find confusion, is they try to find the value of performance art in the same way you maybe would find a value of a painting or a song by looking at like the actual artifacts left behind, when in reality the artifact left behind in a performance is within your own consciousness. It's the experience you had, whether that's, you know, whether that's positive or negative. It could be a scary experience as well.
Fair enough. Well, the mocking of it, anyone saw The Big Lebowski, there's the landlord scene where he's on stage in like a tutu doing this kind of awful dance, but that's our idea.
And I think of the woman painting, swinging back and forth on the swing.
And that was a little better.
That's
a little better.
Conceptual.
I'm going to just explain a performance art piece I was part of. Then we're going to play a track on this album. But I'm a cellist. And there was a woman named Jenny Nissenson, who a fabulous performer, performance artist, and Susie Williams, you might know her. I was playing cello naked. Susie was in a dress made of waffles. She was naked, but waffles were strung together, and Jenny was pouring syrup on her.
That's art.
And my cello was beautiful, and I don't know, it was so bizarre. I didn't know what to think of it, but it. Everybody loved it. So that I'm legit.
Yeah, Ryan just backed up Susie on bass at a little thing at Beyond Baroque.
That's right.
One big lovin'. What is this tune?
So we're going to listen to a song for Barbara Smith called "Feed Me,"
and this is off your album called
"Ekphrasis Synesthesia: Songs for Artists," which are 26 tribute songs to visual and conceptual artists. This is a duet I did with a singer named Kate Crash.
Surreal, can't you feel it's about to heal?
If art is life and life is art, where do we stop and where do we start?
Abramovic.
Oh yeah, she's a big star.
Yeah, that was the one. And she said after it was done, after like people had touched her in very private ways and everything, the men particularly couldn't look at her in the eye afterwards. So that was, you know, an interesting statement about intimacy and sexuality and embarrassment. Yeah, yeah. And
at a time when those issues were coming up in our world. She did that in the midst of what we call the sexual revolution or whatever.
Recently, we witnessed a piece that was almost the inverse of that, where someone sat naked and you had to look them in the eyes, and that was the point of the piece, almost flipping that on its head.
And have sex with them? No. Just look at them.
No, just look at them.
Okay. You have to have sex, and you have to look at them. Now, that's radical. That's outrageous. Where do we go from here? Why don't we take a little left turn? We'll come back to the dark Bob.
All righty.
Let's talk to Ryan Zinn. Let's get you in this conversation. Do you're doing something kind of orthogonal.
Yeah,
kind of. You're doing something orthogonal.
Orthogonal, and we're kind of...
I had to throw in that word sometime in my life.
Good SAT word. I'm glad we used that. Yeah, orthogonal and kind of relating to vocabulary and words.
Okay, go. Explain.
Yeah, a recent project I've been working on, it's called the Emoji Language, and it's essentially a constructed language that anyone around the world can learn, regardless of their, you know, language or cultural background. And they can learn to use this language, which is written only using emojis, which, you know, you can find on your phone or any digital device. And you can learn this language in less than a day, in about an hour, or, you know, about an hour to get proficient with it or start to become proficient. And then you can use it to communicate with anyone else in the world or anyone else who's learned this same system. And there's a couple, like, key things that make it really easy to learn and kind of... differentiate it from other attempts in the past to kind of create symbolic languages or even create some sort of communicators using emojis. But it's really special in the fact that it removes any sort of influence from other existing languages, which is different from like past constructed languages. So for example, say Esperanto, which is one of the most famous ones, it's based very heavily, say, on German, Polish, English, I believe Italian, you know, Western Romance European language. And Romance languages, which that makes it really easy to learn if you grew up speaking a Romance language, say, but if you grew up speaking Japanese, for example, it really doesn't help you at all that it takes all that vocabulary there. So what the emoji language essentially is trying to create a totally level playing field in that sense. So the word for car or to drive in the emoji language is literally just two car emojis. It's two because in the emoji language, all words are made up of exactly two emojis. This makes it really easy to read and write. It's kind of maybe seem a little difficult in the beginning, but once you're confronted with, say, a wall of emoji text, being able to know that every word or concept is two makes it really easy to parse, really easy to learn, and then really easy to read. You can find it and learn it on we have a website as well. You can go to theemojilanguage.com, and I also have an Instagram page, The Emoji Language.
I mean, this sounds revolutionary. This sounds like it could completely change the world.
I believe it really could.
And I've even heard that, like, the people at Duolingo, you know, you're going to put them out of business. They took out a hit on you, I understand.
There's been people following me around sunglasses. It's been
exactly.
Crazy.
No, yeah. But I mean, this actually, honestly sounds like extremely important.
Is this
the thing that we've all been looking for? The, you know, the tablet of knowledge, the Rosetta Stone.
Like a Rosetta Stone in a key that like taps into the core of communication and consciousness in a way, because I really have almost started to see that, because I see, I mean, the symbols that I use, and then you'll look at a painting of the Lascaux Caves, for example, and you'll see similar symbols that we use in emojis to this day, of the three sparkles, potentially meaning like causality or creation. There's the spiral. There's all these kind of universal symbols that pop up throughout, you know, cross-culturally around the world, and that we've almost instinctively known to put into our own syllabary of symbols that we use in the modern world.
You're using a lot of good words, too, syllabary. No, that's a good...
I made a big list that I'm reading off here, but I have them all in emojis, so I'm having to translate them back.
Definitely more advanced than alphabetarian.
That's a good word, or dodecahedron, or...
Well, okay, now you're getting...
Triskaidekaphobia.
You're getting geometrical.
Those are too geometric. We got to get back to our words.
Oh, if we want to do this, Ryan, I'll go in there with you.
I have a big word off. We can try our best. I don't think
you want to go there with Mystic Pete. But
all my words are only two emoji long.
And my omphaloskepsis.
Ooh, you win.
Boom.
Wow. I don't even know if I can define that.
Okay, so the point I was getting to, there's definitely something spiritual going on here, and if you get too close to God with it, like Tower of Babel now, you could get in trouble. I mean, the universal knowledge.
That was one of the very first things I actually tried to translate while I was still developing the language and the vocabulary, was the Tower of Babel story, or kind of an abridged version. That's really a classic among... Conlangers or creators of constructive
Conlangers.
Yeah, that's new one for me. Like the moniker of someone who creates constructed languages. And there's a pretty healthy community, especially on Reddit and on YouTube.
But for like Klingon and people all this
Klingon,
kind of
and then people that make their own as well. You know, inspired by Klingon or inspired by real languages. And people make, oh, what would English sound like in 1,000 years? And but one of the interesting things I think of in the emoji language being symbolic and symbol-based is that it isn't susceptible to that kind of shift the same way that spoken languages are. So English in 1,000 years will sound totally different, probably be incomprehensible to us if we were, you know, able to be subjected to it. But the emoji for the car is always going to be a car. So almost thinking way into the future, that's a kind of symbolic language you could say teach to someone on a space mission going off through cryo sleep for, you know, light years off into space or something. And that language, symbolic language, would always stay constant and be able to be used and communicate back with.
All right, let's go to another song. Yeah. Just give us a little breath.
All right, but that was amazing. Yeah, that was really
Ryan's brilliant.
I mean, I think of someone whose only language is Chinese speaking with someone whose only language is Arabic or something.
I've done a few experiments like
this
that.
This is massive if it works.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Number six?
Sure, let's see. Number six is a song dedicated to the feminist artists of the 1970s in L.A. It's called Take Back the Night, and it features some popular L.A. musicians. Dave Alvin from the Blasters is playing guitar on here. DJ Bonebreak from X is playing drums. And Ryan right here is playing guitar and bass. And it's being sung by Sid Straw. You might remember Sid. She used to be quite the singer. She still is.
There we go.
You'll hear.
We are making an art that's not just for art's sake or an art that's about personal expression, but an art that's about changing the world. And we believe, I do believe, that art can change the world.
Artist, is there some kind of unique representation that will emerge from the experience of being female?
KXLU 88.9 FM in Los Angeles, KXLU com all around the world. By the way, if you're not able to hear this show right now because you're not near a computer or something, you can just download an app right now and you can hear on your phone. So anybody who's not tuned in at all, I'm just telling you a way you can actually get access to us. That was a little humor.
I'm sorry.
Was that irony? Because if they're not listening, they wouldn't have heard me.
Okay. Now I'm getting it.
I'm boring everyone. Okay.
No, I'm getting it now.
We have Dark Bob here and Ryan Zinn, Z-I-N. Dark Bob LA, the Dark Bob Elliott on Instagram, and Ryan underscore Zinn underscore music on Instagram. Dark Bob, let's talk to you a minute. And now we're in the official reminiscing portion of the show.
All right.
And I'm gonna say some words, some names, and you're gonna talk about them.
Wow, let's see what happens.
Well, we already got to Barbara Smith, right?
We did. We played a song for her, Barbara.
Did we do Chris Burden?
Chris Burden is the fellow that famously had himself shot as an artwork in the 70s, and that piece is quite a turning point for art. Because you hear some guy had himself shot and he called it art. Well, okay, then what can art possibly be? I dug it because, it was right around the era of punk and so on. And really, if you look at American culture, we all grew up with cowboy movies, guns. So an artist finally just put a bullet through his body and called it art, and it seemed to make sense.
Chris Burden, Paul McCartney. There we go.
Yeah. Well, Paul used to, stick various things inside his body wherever he could and throw up in front of his audience and dip his private parts in paint and wiggle across a canvas and now Paul is probably in the 1% of the global art world. He's a very famous artist right now. He's really doing museum shows one after another, and I'm very glad for him. He makes a lot of money and people love him. And he wrote yesterday.
The one that didn't chart. The alternative version.
Right.
So you have some association with these people.
Oh, yeah. They were my colleagues and peers back in the 70s. And, we all kept up with what one another was doing, mostly through High Performance Magazine, which was published by Linda Fry Burnham. And, in fact, the Getty Museum is currently celebrating the 50th anniversary of High Performance Magazine. Mm. And it is shared performance art at that time throughout the world, really. It was sort of the cafe where all of us artists would meet and keep up with what one another were doing. And you do a performance and you send a photo and a description to Linda and she'd publish it.
This is all coming out of L.A. and you kind of all
mostly
know each other.
Yeah, yes.
A lot of it. Some on the East Coast. But.
And, I hold performance, Los Angeles performance art in high regard as establishing many of the variations of approaches to doing performance art, from cabaret to time-based to body, politics, gender. All these things really came out of L.A. first, if you ask me.
Well, we are kind of the edge of the edge.
Yeah.
And there's this notion that a lot of culture kind of starts here and kind of rolls east. But, there are a lot of shamans here. There's a lot of visionaries, a lot of desperate people. There's a lot of mean people. But, it's a lot's coming. And everybody comes here to get famous and do their art. So it's this pool
Yes.
Seething artistic talent. And we all are desperate, so we dig deep. And we have to, if we want to be seen or heard, we have to do something interesting and new. So this evolutionary pool, as hard as it is, creates a lot of talent. We have to find something original. And I think that drives a lot of the art here.
And I wish I was the one who said what you just said.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
because you're 100% correct.
Why don't we go on to something I can't talk about because I've never heard of these people, the Kipper Kids.
Well, the Kipper Kids were the only other art team I can think of back in those days. They weren't quite as multimedia as Bob and Bob. They would just get on stage. They're from England. But they identify as Los Angeles artists because this is where they did most of their important work. They at one time I talked about the connection of performance art to punk. They opened for the Sex Pistols at the Olympia Theater. But what they did instead of coming out and doing music, they just started throwing ink and baked beans at each other and. You know, popping balloons with darts and, you know, getting the crowd messy with all sorts of substances they were throwing around. And then the Sex Pistols came out.
But it was entertaining. It wasn't just stupid. It was somehow engaging.
It was somehow. In fact, HBO did some pieces with the Kipper Kids, and they looked great. They had a great name. And, and they did a wild performance that was really dangerous and yet...
At least entertain us, even if it
was entertaining.
Doesn't shift the world consciousness.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Then we have Joanna Wendt. A lot of people have heard of her.
Joanna, again, you know, a big connection to the punk world. Joanna came to fame, let's call it fame, in the 80s in all of LA's punk clubs back then. She was doing a bit of music, but also designing these incredible costumes that she would wear and throwing animal blood around, and of course the crowd loved all that, and screaming sort of maybe a bit like Yoko or whatever. And a lot of these artists I'm currently working, and Ryan's in on this project as well, doing a documentary movie about the early days of LA performance art. And I'm working with a fellow named Michael Masucci from EZTV. And EZTV has been around for 40 years in L.A., and they were pioneers in the new medium of video back when people had to carry big packs on their back. And so it's an Emmy-winning – he won an Emmy for a documentary about dance, and we're doing a documentary about performance art because what is performance art? We're going to let you know.
That's where we started with this show tonight. But
right.
These are like really important cultural touchstones that came out of L.A. And a lot of it's just getting forgotten, but it's so vital and interesting and so much a part of evolution and moving ahead into the future.
And there is a lot of institutional recognition now. There is a performance art museum that is, I think they recently found a space in Los Angeles, and they are going to preserve and present the documentation of performance art as if, well, they're a museum. And places like the Getty Museum and MoCA are all beginning to acknowledge what happened many years ago and bringing performance art into the territory of fine art, which is where it belongs. That's where it came from. And,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
Second to the last person, the penultimate person I will ask you about, who I worked with some, Rachel Rosenthal. I'm, you know, a cellist, and I was part of her kind of a side person for a few shows.
I'm impressed.
A few months, her place on Robertson, Rachel
yes.
Rosenthal.
Yeah, her place on Robertson, the city has deemed that a cultural treasure, her old studio, and there's a plaque in the sidewalk honoring Rachel. And Rachel was a very popular artist. She had a theater background. She was very savvy with lights and costume and dialogue and music, and she could command big crowds at the Wadsworth Theater or Mark Taper. I mean, she really did some big works. I collaborated with Rachel on an epic piece called Kabbalah Mobile, which we performed in 1984 for the opening of the Museum of Contemporary Art. And it was a huge production with the stunt car drivers. We took over a parking lot in downtown L.A. I did the music, Rachel did the words, and I was honored to work with her, and she's quite a legend, Rachel.
Kind of a powerful being.
Absolutely. How exciting you got to work with her.
Yeah,
that's really amazing.
I'm very glad I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I miss her. She passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
She was a real force.
And I was rather close to several of the people in her company. I think that's how I got in. But
nice.
Because I'm part of the dance community. And
yes.
Whatever. There's this cross-pollination happening in Los Angeles. Again, a lot of it's because we're all desperate and nobody's noticing us and we just have to find other people to do things with who will work for free, whatever. And that, you know, artists kind of always do well in difficult circumstances. Give us a war or a plague or something and we'll turn it into art.
And, yeah. I agree. And I think in L.A. there really was a lot of cross-pollination. I know in those early days, you know, if you were a chef or a designer or a painter or a musician, you know, you found each other if you were on the cutting edge of curiosity. And so we had a lot of cross-pollination among different disciplines here.
Well, the last act I'll ask you about in this section of the show is Bob and Bob. So talk more about what you guys did. I mean, you had so many parts to the story, but pick out a couple of them.
Right. We were a multimedia an art team. Yeah, that's right. And so we painted and drew. We did performances. We just did things in the street in the beginning. There was no audience for performance art. So you just did these live actions in the street. Whoever happened to be around, they would be your witnesses, so to speak.
Yeah, well, Keith Haring did that.
That's right, in the subways and so on. Right.
A lot of them did it. Thanks, yeah.
And you never thought to yourself, oh, I'm going to get rich doing this or anything. You know, we always did feel like someday the art world would catch up to us. We'll just keep doing it and document it. And it has. You know, we're in some museums and we're housed in the archives of American art, our stuff. But it was an exciting journey of exploration and dare. We didn't know what we were doing.
Describe it more.
Let me see. We made records. We made films. We did paintings. But we were always on the... for example, we landed a big record deal with Polygram Records in the mid-80s, and we did a record. We have sort of a little hit, and this is maybe a good story to show where we were coming from. So the Johnny Carson's Tonight Show, we had a record on Polygram, right? So in those days, all those big corporations were connected. So we got a call to appear on the Tonight Show. And at the time, we were promoting the record by doing live shows where we would do large paintings as the song played. So we wanted to do this painting on the Tonight Show, and they wouldn't let us, so we walked away. And, you know, so people say, you're crazy, man. You could have been on the Tonight Show. But, you know, that isn't who we were. I'm glad that there isn't some video of us on the Tonight Show lip-syncing a song like we want to be rock stars, because that is not what we were trying to do. Had they let us do a painting, that would have been really cool, because it was to watch us paint live. It was messy and fun and exciting, and the music enhanced watching these two guys paint. And it was something we did anyway. Live painting was one of our performance staples, and so we had a great time. There were books written about us. You know, we thought we were really something back in the day, and then we went our separate ways for a long time. We've done a lot of solo work, but we're back together now, getting ready for this drawing retrospective next year, and it's really fun to work together and to be with each other. We have a long history, and it's nice that we've had some recognition from the institutions.
Yeah, as you should, and it's very heartening to hear that you kept your art clean and pure, and you didn't, you know, sell out to the man.
Yeah, it wasn't about that. We had people come to us, they wanted to make... there was a movie offer from ICM. They wanted, let's see, they were going to make a movie about Bob and Bob in Beverly Hills. Well, our first studio was in Beverly Hills somehow. It was the cheapest place we could find, this old building on right in the heart of Beverly Hills on Little Santa Monica and Beverly Boulevard. in a building owned by Dean Martin. We found a $100 studio, so we started making art in Beverly Hills, sort of reflecting on this consumer crazy culture that we were in suddenly, and doing a lot of art that made comment about consumerism and wealth and everything else that was going on in those days. So somebody wanted to make a movie about these two crazy guys in the midst of affluence and how they didn't quite fit. And let's see, John Lovitz was going to play me, and I can't remember who was going to play the light bulb. But anyway, it all fell apart. So that was a story I maybe shouldn't even have started. But like many things in Hollywood, you know, the ambition was there, but it did fall apart.
Well, project. You know, this is where art and commerce meet, and it's a difficult marriage. And,
yes.
I mean, but, you know, if Johnny Carson asked me to come on and, you know, stand on my head and play the cello, you know, I would, like, sell my wife into slavery to get on to Johnny Carson.
I loved Johnny. And, it was hard to say no, honestly.
And I'm not even married.
There you go.
Body's spinning, nobody losing, and everybody's winning. Men, women, start out swimming, legs kicking, and their body's spinning.
Me joy.
Pushing, shoving, a whole lot of loving. Food is flying everywhere. Chicken, fish, a rack of lamb, and it's all getting stuck in your hair. In the
Zen, tell us about that tune. That was you on guitar.
That was me on guitar in the very end, and that's a song that Dark Bob and I produced in my home studio, and kind of a good example of how we work together, actually. We started that, or had him start that, when he played just some random synthesizer notes doing that synth bass to a click track, and then I had him play some more random notes in the bridge part, in the singing feeling, you know, that kind of build up. And then he really would just start improvising over it, and almost like a collage, he would throw out random stuff, and then it would be my job to assimilate that, synthesize new things from that, make it all work, and then an hour later give it back to him. He'd throw something new on it, mess it all up, and then I'd have to, you know, forges of creation,
no, great.
Smooth it all out back together, and then back and forth, we'd do that process.
Now I'm really happy with the way that came out.
It really came out great.
It's a strange track.
And all just building up into almost like a snowball of percussion going down a hill in that final solo, just things.
So a lot of collaboration, improvisation, and really
a lot of
working off each other.
And what I almost think of, I call like structured improvisation. When I do this with a lot of my clients that I record, I'll have them improvise over just like short sections, and then kind of piece them together. So it's not the same pressure of having to say improvise for 2 minutes or, you know, something like that. And I think that's especially helpful if I'm working with rappers or like jazz soloists as well. So take that pressure off and let them really get to the soul of what they want to put out into the music and not have to be caught up in that pressure of having to make one long cohesive improvisation that means something.
Well, Ryan Zinn, we've heard about your adventure into semiotics.
And
now I was just waiting for applause with my word. I am a sesquipedalian.
Ooh.
You started this, man.
I started this. Bigger words.
Now deal with it.
So,
Ryan, now you have a theory about time.
I do have a theory about time, and to kind of preface it, I had almost what I would can't describe it as anything else other than a vision where I almost saw the shape of time, and nervous of calling it a vision, but it wasn't brought on by
drugs
or meditation. It was brought on by knowledge, which makes it feel all the more powerful for me, and I started with this realization that a cave painting is fundamentally the same thing for humanity as a war memorial. And it's that it's a representation and something to give thanks and to commemorate the physical beings or physical bodies of those who had to die and give up their existence in order to hold up our worldview. Whether that's an animal that had to be killed for cave people to survive or someone who died in war to uphold our, say, like political ideologies. It's essentially the same thing. So in my, what I can only call a vision, I saw the moment when humanity is able to send off conscious life into the stars. And I saw the rocket ships go up. And when I saw this, I saw the smoke cloud below the rocket harden into the Great Pyramid of Giza. And it was the day that the Pharaoh had died and he had ascended off into heaven or off into the afterlife. But I saw that just when the rockets went up and just when the Pharaoh ascended into heaven, everything was the same and life continued on. So I climbed up to the top of the pyramid and I looked off and I saw all of human society devolve back to the very first civilization, say like maybe in Ur or Mesopotamia, and then from there devolving back to the very first consciousness. And then from there, back through the animal kingdom to the very first cell. And kind of following the sort of hermetic wisdom of like, as below, so below, I saw really everything fitting into this pattern of cell division or fractals, essentially, always coming from a higher place or a higher cell where everything below it is of that which is above it and, you know, creating that cycle. So it devolved all the way into me essentially seeing the shape of time as infinite logarithmic spirals emanating from one central point. And then along those spirals, every single point has infinite spirals breaking off of it into eternity. And thinking of conceptualizing that space, I'm wondering if we could maybe superimpose that space into our conception of the universe or of the shape of space-time, and potentially we could be able to manipulate the knowledge of that shape to maybe send some sort of beam of light or radio message way far out into space and then potentially looping it back around like a boomerang and understanding that shape and the shape of like fractals and spiral math, potentially having a beam of light breaking our understanding of linear time by being able to loop it back.
I love that you're working on this. You know, I teach mysticism, and I'm of the opinion that time is like taffy. It's flexible. Most people feel it's like a train on a track that keeps going. Of course, like physics is now figuring out, or Einstein, that it is actually fluid in a certain sense. It's mutable.
Absolutely.
But my experience of time, the more, you know, mystical I get, the more time does actually, as an experience, feel pliable. And in fact, I mean, just right now, we've almost been here an hour. It feels like about 5 or 10 minutes.
We've been using such big words that those really
takes up a lot of time too, right? I think performers know the experience of time going very quickly. If you're very engaged, or in a museum, or you're dancing in the, or making love, the whole night can go by in like a flash. Or if you're in a boring economics class where like time is money, actually, literally
it could go really slow.
That clock is ticking, you know.
Absolutely. And going along with that, I kind of conceptualize our experience of time almost as being in like a water park at a lazy river. But imagine that the background of the world is also moving along with you at the same speed. So if the current sped up or slowed down, you might not really know. You might have some sort of vague feeling, like feeling the acceleration or the G-forces or whatever the temporal forces might be. But there might not be any way of really checking, because everything around you is going that same speed.
We are in the closing minutes of the show. I wish we could go deeper. I
got to slow down time, and maybe we could do the show backwards.
I wish I could double the but I actually knew Terrence McKenna, who has a whole theory called the time wave theory. That's a whole nother show. And I challenged him on that, actually, because I disagreed with him. However, the Dark Bob.
Hey, man.
We have
Thank
a couple
you.
Minutes. I just wanted to actually get to one last point.
Absolutely.
Cable TV, because that was another big part.
It was.
And Victoria Looseleaf.
Yes.
Put us together for
yes,
this
she
show.
Did. And Victoria had one of the more popular of those cable TV shows. They were all like Between Two Ferns, if you've been watching any of those episodes. But that was a big thing in the alternative culture. There was Victoria Looseleaf, Joan Quinn, Tosh Berman, Elisha Shapiro, where people got their hands on airwave time for television, and they were able to interview and cajole and speak with cutting edge artists, and Victoria is one of the major. There's a documentary being made about her right now, and about her show. She had all sorts of very interesting artists on there.
Wonderful harpist too, but she has like 400 shows. She did.
Yes, she did, and you know, I was on a few of them. I had Bob and Bob and. We were part of her world, all right.
And the performance art scene was present.
Absolutely. Victoria was very in the know back then, and interviewed many of these people we've been talking about, and bringing them to a wider audience that they otherwise wouldn't have had but for cable TV.
Well, this is actually very important archival information and imagery about Los Angeles.
Yes,
this is the real history. This is the real people, not like the official legitimate celebrity culture. That's, you know,
right.
This is the people of LA.
And it is now being collected and you know, brought. It's being put together by museums and so on, so that it is accessible to us, all this information from that alternative world.
Well, closing statements, guys, and then we're going to make room for Pat with Alien Air. He's going to take us up till 10 p.m. I hope everybody stays tuned to KXLU 24 hours a day. By the way, I will be on again next Sunday with a professor at Loyola Marymount University named Alexandros, talking about Greek culture and playing Greek music. So that should be a very interesting show a week from tonight. I just kind of go all over the place. I have a music show on Saturday night and Monday late, which is called In a Dream, features the DJ community. It's what you kids listen to with the wicka, 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 wicka.
That's what right. I've been listening to every day.
That's exactly what I do. Closing statements.
Club sandwiches, not baby seals.
Well,
oh, that's a good one.
That's a good closing statement. Final call to action out there. Everyone pull out their phone, look us up. You can find me on any of my various websites. You can find me at ryansinmusic.com. You can find the emoji language and start learning it today at theemojilanguage.com. And you can start learning about time travel and some of the possible ramifications of it at vortextimetravel.com. And you can see some very interesting diagrams and spirals.
Well, we have just a couple more minutes. The computer's running a little late here. Any positive, encouraging words? We're in such times of change and so much chaos, and people are scared and speculate. What do we do, guys?
Well, that's a tough one. I tend to get pessimistic these days, and I don't want to be. Can you offer anything optimistic, Ryan?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are feeling really pessimistic, but I think more and more, I mean, the stuff I've been working on is showing this, the stuff other physicists are working on is starting to show this, is that you really do live in the world that you create in your own consciousness. So try really hard to create a positive world. And I mean, reality isn't just created by your consciousness, it's created by everybody's, you know, working together, but yours does play an important part in that. So being a positive actor in that sense, even just in your own personal capacity, very important. So continue with that.
We have some agency.
You do.
Very
nice. We all do.
Ryan Zinn Music.
That is
on
me.
Instagram. The Dark Bob LA.
That's it.
On Instagram. I'm Mystic Pete on social media and mysticpete.com. Thank you so much for coming. We will have you all back.
Thank
it's
you.
Just been delightful. We'll do it again.
Yay.
We'll keep going.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Listening to KXLU at LMU, 88.9 FM, Los Angeles.